Yeah, we are, as you indicated, we're going to be doing Megillas Rus till Shavuos. And again, just to go over the basic story, our cast of characters are right in the beginning of Megillas Rus. Again, if people want to Chumash, the Chumash has the Megillah in it. This is a story that occurred in the days of the judges judging. Now, that is not a very good date. That's like saying this occurred sometime in the Middle Ages. You know, the Middle Ages were hundreds of years. The period of the Shoftim, which is the period of the judges before there was a king, before Shaul HaMelech, is a period that spans approximately 350 years. So what is the significance of saying that this is a story that occurred in the period of the judges? That doesn't tell you when it occurred. That's hundreds of years. So because of this, Chazal have a drasha, and this only emerges from the Hebrew. Shavot HaShoftim does not mean when the judges were judging, which is one translation, and that's probably how the English has it, but it means when the judges were judged. Meaning, the purpose of this pasuk is not to give you a historical date, but it is to describe the spiritual climate of that generation. It was a generation when the judges were as bad as the people that they were judging. Meaning to say, as Rashi says, if a judge would say to a person, remove that speck of dust in your eye, like an expression, the person would respond, take out that beam that's sticking in your face. Meaning to say, the concept was that whatever the judges would criticize people for, they were guilty of worse averus. This, of course, is a familiar phenomenon in our society as well, in which the paragons of leadership are not really examples. And, well, you know, it's interesting just to mention this as another aspect of it. You know, the Mishnah in Maseches Sota talks about what is going to happen before Mashiach comes. And it mentions that the generation will be, the face of the generation will be like the face of a dog. Now, the expression is not explained. What do you mean the face will be like the face of a dog? So they say in the name of Yisrael Salanter that the panim, the face, refers to the leaders of the generation that give it direction and guidance. So what is the characteristic of a dog? Imagine a person walking a dog. The dog is in front of the person, but every two steps the dog looks back to see where the master goes. This is a trained dog we're talking about. So the idea is a leader is supposed to be somebody that is giving direction and giving guidance. But before Mashiach comes, the leaders will simply turn around to see where the followers want to go. And that's where they're going to change their direction. What is the phrase? They spit into the wind, see which way it blows, or polls, right? Every decision, you know. You'll be in favor of abortion this week if the poll says 51%. It's amazing how, as the polls change, politicians have these spiritual, you know, I was rethinking the issue, you know, and I've come to a new conclusion, which happens to correspond exactly with whatever the majority of the polls say. And this is exactly Pnei Hador.
Except behind people.
Well, okay, that's a question of money versus votes. That's the show of death control, because the amount of money, whatever, okay, I'm going to have the lecture on that coming up.
You know, some congregants are changing the rabbi. It's like changing the rabbi.
I once had to do legal research on this issue. Maybe I should talk about it, about congregations firing rabbis. I went and did another. And it's interesting. There were rabbis who took the halachic position that they're really not allowed to be fired, which is really a slur in halacha. And the board of directors did not agree. They fired him. And the rabbi continued. I mean, really awful. These are court cases, awful story. The rabbi continued, and they hired a new rabbi. And the old rabbi continued, and he insisted on getting up, and the new rabbi insisted on getting up, and there were fights, in the shul itself. So these things happened. And there was one synagogue in Queens that had this litigation for 18 years. Just read like 20 court opinions at different points about this old rabbi that didn't give up, so to speak. Okay, but be this as it may, the chiddush of Bimei Shvot HaShoftim, therefore, is it's not telling you when it happened, because it's over a 350-year period, but it's describing the generation as a corrupt and perverse generation, where even the leaders were not living by a very high standard, and that's why we're going to see, Taka, that some of the sins in Perek Aleph are sins of leadership. And as a result, it explains the story that is going to go on. And the story begins that during this period of abdication of leadership, there was a famine in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, and that happens a lot. The rain doesn't come. And a man from Beis Lechem Yehuda. Now, what's Beis Lechem? Beis Lechem Yehuda. We all know where Beis Lechem is. Beis Lechem is south of Yerushalayim. That is where Rachel is buried. And the reason it is called Beis Lechem Yehuda is simply because in the tribal division of Eretz Yisrael, Beis Lechem, as well as Yerushalayim, was in the Chelek of Yehuda. In fact, we know, by the way, that Beis Lechem was the ancestral home of David HaMelech. David and Yishai lived in Beis Lechem.
And Peres gave it to the
Okay. All right, that's another problem. But and therefore, there was a man from Beis Lechem Yehuda who went to live in the fields of Moab. He, his wife, and his two sons.
Oh, no way.
So let's think about this again. Where is today Moab, the fields of Moab? So remember who Moab is, right? Moab was the son that Lot had from his daughter. Right? In the aftermath of Sodom, Lot's daughters committed incest with their father. They got their father drunk two nights in a row. Each time resulted in a pregnancy and a conception. The child from the first daughter, the oldest daughter, she called Moab, which really means Mayav from my father. The child from the second conception, the younger daughter, called Ammon, which means from my nation. Chazal actually say, for this reason, Ammon is marginally a little spiritually better than Moab, because there's more tzniyas in their name. I mean, Moab from my father, at least Ammon from my nation, from my people. Now, we know, therefore, that Ammon and Moab are nations that were generated from incest. And we also know that the territory that was given to the descendants of Lot, as Ammon and Moab are called, is the territory that is east of the Yarden. But again, you have to differentiate. This is not the territory east of the Jordan that was given to the 2.5 tribes. The territory east of the Jordan that was given to the 2.5 tribes, Reuven, Gad, and Chazi Shevet Menashe, that was conquered from Sichon, who was an Amorite king, and Og, the king of Bashan. Sichon is an Amorite, meaning he's from Canaan. He's a Canaanite. And in reality, Chazal do teach us that Sichon had conquered it from Moab, but we conquered it from Sichon. Right, so that's a portion of that land east of the Jordan. However, the land that is south of that, that's around the Dead Sea and south, that is the land of Ammon and Moab. In particular, we're talking about Moab, though. So therefore, just to imagine the trip here, the basic trip would be, they went from Beis Lechem south, eastward, to the plains of Moab, which were very fertile. Even today, you'll notice that the east bank of the Jordan is a very, very fertile. That's why, number one, the 2.5 tribes wanted that area, because it was rich in grass and the like. In fact, you look at the Israeli side, it's very dry. Of course, part of that is because they keep it as a security zone. They don't plant up to the river. But it is very stark. To this day, the lack of vegetation on the west bank is very different than the very plush greenery on the east bank. So it says that these people went Lagur to dwell in the fields of Moab, he, his wife, and his two sons, and then were given their names. The name of the man was Elimelech, the name of his wife was Naomi, the name of his two sons were Machlon and Chilion. We'll go back to the meaning of these names. Now here it mentions they were Ephrasim. So the question is, what does the word Ephrasim mean? So Ephrasim is sometimes translates as from the tribe of Ephraim. It's related to Ephraim, which would seem to be contradictory, because Beis Lechem will belong to the tribe of Yehuda. Were they simply Ephraimites who were living there? But Chazal translate Ephrasim is Ephrat means, like Ephrat, it's Lashon of fruitful. They were fruitful, productive, distinguished people. So you would call a nobility, an aristocracy of sorts, as Ephrasim. Again, connected to Bein Porat Yosef. Yosef is a very fruitful, productive person. And they went to Moab, and they were there. And then it mentions Elimelech died, and Naomi was left with her two sons. And then it mentions the two sons married Nashim Moabias. Now, let's stop right off the bat and say the following. Elimelech is not defined specifically as being a shofetz in the Megillas Rus. On the other hand, Chazal understood that Elimelech was a leader of the generation in a number of ways. And why did Elimelech die, etc.? And why did the two sons die? So Chazal understood that there was something sinful that was committed for which God took them out of the world. Now, what was the nature of the chait? So there are many interpretations in the Gemara Bava Basra. What was the chait for which Elimelech, let's take Elimelech first, Elimelech dying. One was the chait of leaving the land of Israel, even in time of famine. And the reason is that one does not have faith that Hashem will remember the people, and one is not supposed to leave Eretz Israel even when times are difficult. Of course, there are problems with that, because after all, when there was a famine in the days of Abraham, Abraham went to Mitzrayim. Now, the truth of the matter is, if you look in the Perush of the Ramban,
but he was not punished.
The Ramban actually says that for Avram to go to Mitzrayim was a chait, and that is why Sarah was taken by Paro. So the Ramban does say Avram did a chait. So according to the Ramban, it would be consistent, although Avram was not punished the same way Elimelech was punished. Yitzchak, as you recall, was specifically told not to go to Mitzrayim, but that's a separate matter. That's because Yitzchak was sanctified as a korban, as an offering, and therefore he couldn't leave. So that's not a proof. So one interpretation is that the Aveira of everybody was they left Eretz Yisrael in a time of famine. The other reason that the Gemara gives is that they were rich enough to move, and there were so many other Jews who were not able to move, and they were stuck there. And what they did is they demoralized the spirits of those who had to stay. It's like the lifeboat analogy, right? What would be, like in the Titanic, whatever, the captain, whatever, the captain is the first one who jumps ship, right? What type of courage does that give for the people who have to remain behind? So it wasn't so much that they left the land of Israel, that was the sin. The sin was the demoralizing impact they had on those who had to make it through. That's a second Aveira. A third Aveira was that Elimelech left because the truth of the matter is he had plenty of resources. He could have made it through the famine. But he didn't want people to bother him for contributions. He left because of Sarut Ayin. He did not want to share what he had with others. And that's why there's poetic justice in why of all the countries that he chose, he chose to go to Moab. Why Moab? Because remember why the Moabites are not allowed to marry into the Jewish people? Because when we're wandering through the desert, we ask them for food and water, and they did not offer. In effect, Elimelech's attitude is, I'll go to the Moabites, they'll understand. In other words, they will be sympathetic to the notion. I don't want my resources to be depleted by incessant demand. So essentially, we have three different readings why Elimelech was punished this way. One was the fact that he left the land of Israel, which shows a lack of faith. The other is that he demoralized the people that had to remain. And the third is the selfishness of not wanting to share his nechassim with others. Now, what's interesting is, though, that Elimelech died, but then we're told that the two boys, Mahlon and Chileon, married Moabite women, and then Mahlon and Chileon died. Now, the question is, what's going on here? They married Moabite women? So one fundamental question is, did these women convert? Or did they not convert? Now, the Targum Yonasan Ben Uziel, which is the Aramaic translation, actually says that Mahlon and Chileon died because they committed the sin of marrying non-Jewish women, meaning the whole discussion I gave you is why Elimelech died. Those were those three reasons. Mahlon and Chileon committed an Aveira of marrying non-Jewish women. And yet, if you look in the Gemara implies that they didn't commit this Aveira. We'll discuss why. And they died for the same reason that their father died. Now, so to understand this, one of the fundamental questions in Megillas Rus is, who are the two girls? The two girls are Rus and Orpah. Rus and Orpah. Now, it does not say in the Megillah at all that Rus and Orpah were sisters. It does not say that. And yet, once again, there's a rabbinic tradition that Rus and Orpah were in fact sisters. And they were the daughters of the king of Moab, Eglon, the king of Moab. And in fact, we know a little bit about Eglon Melech Moab.
That must be the same mother.
Right, they were half-sisters. Eglon Melech Moab was the king of Moab. He's in the book of Shoftim. And if you recall, that he was waging war against the Jewish people at various times. And he was actually assassinated by one of the judges, Ehud ben Gera. And there's a whole story that Ehud gained admittance to tell him something, and Eglon was very corpulent. And Ehud, like, stuck a knife into his belly, and the belly was big enough that the knife got submerged into the whole thing. And Eglon just died, was left for dead, and he was found a short while later. Right. Right, so Chazal make the amazing statement that when Ehud ben Gera came in and said, "I have a message from Hashem for you," Eglon stood up and he took three steps forward in honor of God. And because of those three steps that he took forward, he was Zocha to have Rus, who is the great grandmother of David HaMelech. And Chazal say that you see from here the very important teaching that there's no good deed, no matter how insignificant, that Hashem does not give tremendous amounts of reward. Of course, maybe for him walking three steps was a big deal, you know, we don't know. But the point is that Eglon was a Rasha, but he was Zochet to have Rus and Orpah. So according to tradition, Rus and Orpah are both sisters. They are the daughters of the king of Moab. Now you can understand, whether they converted or not, I'll discuss in a moment, but you can understand the shidduch here, because Elimelech is a very prominent family. And therefore he comes to Moab as a wealthy man, as a respected man. And of course the Moabites see a man that agrees with their basic social policy of not helping other people. And there's a royal marriage, in effect. This is the marriage of two, of course there weren't royalty in the Jewish people, but, you know, aristocracy and royalty, right? It was the marrying Diana, right? Philip and Diana marriage was a big deal, probably. And Chazal also point out that all of the names here have symbolic value. That Rus, the shorish of Rus, comes from Raveh. To be Marveh is to saturate. She was the ancestor of David HaMelech, who saturated Hashem with songs of glory. Rus. Orpah is the back of the neck. She was Orpah because she turned around. She left Naomi. Now, what does that mean? I mean, does that mean that when Eglon or Mrs. Eglon named these daughters Rus and Orpah, she had this in mind? Of course she did not have this in mind. She named Rus after Aunt Ruth and Orpah after, you know, Aunt Orpah, whatever it was. But we mean to say that the name, and this is true for us even today, the name that God causes us to choose will be reflective.
Naomi also named them Mahlon.
Yeah, I'll come. I'm taking one at a time. I'll come to those names. The name that Hashem puts in our minds has a higher spiritual purpose of which we're not even aware. So they weren't aware of Rus and Orpah, but that was the name. Right? That was the name that was given. That's why the name at a bris, the Ari writes, the name that we give a child at a bris is a prophecy from Hashem as to some fundamental character of the child. This is taken to such an extreme that some are of the opinion that if a wrong name is given at a bris, it cannot be changed. Sometimes you have this, I saw this twice, where the name is Shalom, and the one that's announcing the name says Shlomo. Now sometimes that's just an accident, you didn't hear right, but I've been in cases where some of the deliberate changes, right? Let's say the grandfather is naming the baby, and the parent wants a certain name, and the grandfather wants it to be named after his grandfather or something. So grandfather just changes the name. And there's some question whether that's the name. So the truth is, I was at a bris with the same gadol, where this happened twice, two different brises. And one time he said, "You cannot change it."
But
one time
name.
He said, "You could." You can always add, listen, I mean, the truth of the matter is, we have a lot of flexibility for names. I mean, the truth of the matter is, according to halacha, you know, you can just take whatever name you want, and if that's what you're known as, that does become your name. In fact, it's actually easier to change a name in halacha than it is secularly. Even for a get, in which names have to be very, very exact, if you decided, let's say, 30 years ago, that you were not going to use a certain name, and you go by another name, and for 30 years, that's how you're known, that automatically, of course, the question is how long a period does it take, but after some point, that becomes your name. There's not really a formality. But nevertheless, there is a concept that the spiritual essence of someone is expressed by the name that they're given.
Sometimes children also change. They don't like their name and they change it.
So sometimes who?
Children.
Yeah, well, you know, there are people who like their middle name and they go by their middle name, right? So a lot of times we do that. But that's with Rus and Orpah. Now, Elimelech, of course, theoretically should be a very good name. Elimelech is God is my king, or my God is my king. And Naomi, of course, means sweetness. And of course, Naomi herself later on plays on her name by saying, "Why are you?" When she comes back all alone, "Why are you calling me Naomi, the sweet one? You should call me Mara, the bitter one." So Naomi herself has a recognition. Now, a little word. Let me go Machlon Bechilion. Now, Machlon Bechilion, the Gemara says, has the following symbolic meaning. Machlon is from the word Mechila, which is forgiveness. That Machlon was eventually forgiven because he was the one that married Rus, and his line was perpetuated through Rus.
And comes from
Chilion is destruction, because he married Orpah and nothing came from it. Now, in Divrei Hayamim, in the Book of Chronicles, which often gives you lineages with different names, Divrei Hayamim is very complicated, sometimes gives you the same people, Machlon and Chilion are given two other names. They are given Yoash v'Sorach. And Yoash is a reference to a negative aspect, Shenis Ya'ashu min ha-ge'ula, that by moving to Moab, they gave up hope that there would be a redemption. That's a sin. And Sorach is like Chilion. Sorach means one was totally burnt up or totally destroyed, right? So we have these different names. And there's a machlokas in the Gemara where their real names, Machlon v'Chilion and Yoash v'Sorach, are their symbolic names. Or were their real names, Yoash and Sorach and Machlon v'Chilion, are their symbolic names. You have to understand that in Tanakh, there's a certain fluidity of name, meaning sometimes, in fact, maybe they weren't even named Rus and Orpah. Sometimes when it says somebody's name was so-and-so, it doesn't even mean that was what they were called. It just means that is what reflects their spiritual essence. In other words, maybe they call them something else. We don't even know what people were called, but their name is their identity and their focus. Right? So these are some of the references to the names. Now, one other word about Yichus, because in order to understand the picture here, you need to know about the family relationships a little bit more. Rashi tells us the following, that Elimelech, Salmon is Boaz's father. Elimelech, Salmon, and a fellow that's called Tov, he's the other relative who comes at the end of the story. They were all the sons of the famous Nachshon ben Aminadav. Now remember who Nachshon ben Aminadav is. Nachshon ben Aminadav was the head of the tribe of Yehuda at the time of the Exodus of Egypt, and he was the one who jumped into the Yamsuf before it split. And in his faith in Hashem's promises, he merited that there would be this great miracle. So Elimelech is the son of Nachshon ben Aminadav. Now again, now you can understand why Nachshon named his son Elimelech, God is my king. And yet, isn't it ironic and even tragic that the son of Nachshon ben Aminadav, who had the total emunah in Hashem's promises, his son was the one who left Eretz Yisrael in the time of the famine. And maybe that's why he's condemned so much, because you might say, I mean, listen, all right, it's not the greatest thing to do, but is it such an avera for which one deserves to die? It could very well be that maybe there were other people who left too, and they were not punished so severely. But one who is, number one, a leader of the people, and number two, a son of Nachshon ben Aminadav, certainly should have faith.
We say from one came a vinegar.
Well, that happens. That happens again. I mean, I don't want to sit in judgment and say vinegar. I mean, Elimelech was probably a very great tzaddik as well, but according to the level to which he should have been, there was an avera in his leaving the land of Israel. Now you might say, does that have implications for us? I mean, you know, people can make aliyah all the time, and unfortunately, well, first of all, most of us don't make aliyah. That's one question, because we say we're not going to be able to make a living. Well, what's going on? I mean, here you see, there was a famine and they were supposed to stay. And let's say you go there and you find you're not able to make a parnassa, so people come back sometimes. Are we to draw an implication that no matter how hard it is, you're supposed to stick it out? Again, halakhically, you don't have any proof, simply because, as I say, part of Elimelech's onesh was his connection to Nachshon ben Aminadab. He was living on a higher level. However, at least as an aspiration, it does indicate to us that one should try, one should be willing to make sacrifices.
When he died, before his son married this foreign girl?
The implication is that he died before they married. Now, there is another medrash that actually says that perhaps he died in a positive vein, that God took him from the world before he saw his sons do such an awful aveira. Now, why wasn't Ami given the same bracha, if we perceive that as a positive thing? But there is a concept that Hashem sometimes takes tzaddikim from the world so they should not see the evil that their children are going to perpetuate. Just like Abraham. If you remember, the day that Esav became an open Russia, he was cooking the lentils, Yaakov was cooking the lentils. So Rashi says that was the day that Abraham died, and Yaakov was preparing the lentils, which a mourner eats for Yitzchak. And that's when Esav became an open Russia and murderer. And Chazal say that Esav did not do anything wrong, openly wrong, in the lifetime of his grandfather. Esav was 15 when his grandfather died. And part of it is because Hashem took Abraham away. See, there's a chicken and egg question here. In other words, the implication of Rashi seems to be that Esav was going to be a Russia that day no matter what, and therefore Hashem took Abraham so he wouldn't see it. That's the idea of taking away the tzaddik so he shouldn't see the Aveira. Because since Hashem promised Abraham, Ki kaver b'seiva tova, you will be buried in a good old age. That was Hashem's promise, that he would not see any of his children become Rishonim. Even Yishmael did Shuvah after Sarah died. So Abraham died without any of his children being Rishonim. However, from a sociological standpoint, I think you might give a different take on it. You might say that maybe it was the opposite. Instead of saying Avram died because Esav was going to become a Russia, you might say Esav became a Russia because Avram died, meaning to say that, as you often see, his relationship with his grandfather allowed him to have a connection. In other words, once again, that Yitzchak was more introspective, etc., and Abraham perhaps was more giving in an open way. And as is often the case, you often find, even, I mean, Havdil in everyday life, that sometimes the loss of the grandparents can really send a troubled child over the edge, because the grandparent was the last support that was unconditional without excessive demands and everything else. And so it might be even that perspective that Chazal are pointing out. It was the day of Abraham's death that made Esav a Russian. That was later. Yeah, we're talking about...
His nature, respect to the...
Oh, yes. In other words, Esav had respect for his parents and his brethren. That's very correct. And Chazal do identify this as Esav's spiritual strength. That is correct.
There's another one that said he was good and God took him.
Chanoch.
Yes.
Chanoch. Well, it doesn't say he was good, but it does say that Hashem took him so he shouldn't see the perversities of the generation before the flood. So that's one thing. So now Boaz, just so you'll get a sense, Boaz is Elimelech's nephew. In other words, Boaz's father was Salmon. Salmon and Elimelech are brothers. Boaz is therefore the son of Salmon. So Boaz and Elimelech are nephew and uncle. And that also means Boaz and Machlon and Chilion are first cousins. That's why, keep in mind, we'll discuss this later, when we get involved in the mitzvah of Yibam, keep in mind that Megillas Rus is not discussing true Yibam. What is true Yibam? If a brother dies without children, there's a mitzvah on his brother to marry the widow. Now keep in mind, Boaz is not Machlon's brother. Boaz is Machlon's cousin. So when we discuss it, keep in mind that we're not really dealing with the technical mitzvah. By the way, people don't realize that the mitzvah of Yibum as a mitzvah does apply today. I mean, people have to know this, that if Chas Shalom, a person dies without any children, his widow is not allowed to marry anyone unless the brother either does Yibam, although I'll say today we don't do Yibam, unless the brother marries her, which it would be difficult if he has a wife, or he releases her through a ceremony that is called Chalitza, and that means he wears a special boots. She pulls it off, she spits in front of him, not in his face, but in front of him, and she says, so shall be done to the man who doesn't want to rebuild his brother's home, and then she's allowed to remarry. I mean, this applies, it's not done that often, and I myself have never seen one. The special boots that are based on like a Viking boots, you know, with straps and everything. But it is true, in such a situation, a woman cannot get married without chalitza. Now, that creates the same type of blackmail that you sometimes have with the gets, where some brother might say, give me $1 million and I'll give you a chalitza. Right? You have that same type of potential. I remember reading an interesting story about Rav Chaim Isaac Grodzinski. Rav Chaim Isaac Grodzinski was the Chafetz Chaim's dear friend, and he was the Gadol Hador in Europe, in fact, not just in learning, but he really kept the yeshivas alive, and he brought all the yeshivas to Vilna, and then he sent them to Shanghai. He really was the address for everything that was going on in Europe in the early years of the Holocaust. He died in 1940. Very, very great man, and an amazing genius. My Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Ritterman Zatzal, as a young person, was very close to Rav Chaim Moser. And he recalls Rav Chaim Moser's apartment in Vilna. He had this long table, like a 30-foot table, and there would be people seated all around the table and coming in. And he would be on two telephones. He would be learning Gemara. He would be writing a tshuva. These are all different things. And like these people who play 50 games of chess at the same time, people would be throwing in questions, personal questions, and halachic questions, and communal questions, and staka questions. And he would be dealing with all of it at the same time. And once in a while, somebody would stop talking because they figured he wasn't listening. They'd go, on, I'm listening, you know. Say. And his wife would be having a conversation in the kitchen, and he would interject there. You know. So he was really just a tremendous whirlwind of activity. And he really kept it. He kept tens of thousands of people alive as well. And he died in 1940, died of cancer. But the story goes that one time he was stuck. He used, because of his health, he had difficulty, bad health, he had many health problems. He would often go to Germany, the hot springs, and different places where people would go. And one time he was stuck there very late in the summer, and it was already time for Selichos. And he's in a city that had almost no religious Jews at all. And here he is, he's all by himself. He's not even a minion of Shomer Shabbos, and it's Selichos, shofar blowing, and he's very, very sad. And, you know, he doesn't know why Hashem is putting him here. So he bumps into a man from Poland, and a regular balabas, and he starts conversing with him and saying, what brings you to Germany here? So the man says, well, I'm here to do a big mitzvah. He says, my brother died recently, and he has a widow with many children, and I want to do her a favor. I never got married. I want to marry her to, raise the children. And I know the halacha is, yibam only applies when there are no children. If there are children, you're actually not allowed to marry your brother's widow. So Rav Chaim Moser is very shocked. He says, you're not allowed to do that. I mean, they're children. You're not allowed to marry your brother's widow. So the person said, you know, I come from Poland where we have, you know, great, great rabbis. I mean, I'm not going to take something from somebody in Germany who tells me this. And, I think it's a big mitzvah. The kids need a parent, and I'm an uncle, and I'm very close to them. And, unless I hear it from an authoritative rabbi, you know, I'm just not going to do it. So Rav Chaim Moser says, well, who would you have to hear it from? So he says, well, Rav Grodzinski of Vilna, you know, somebody big. So he says, well, he says, I don't know how big I am, but, you know, that's me. So he had never met Rav Chaim Moser. So Rav Chaim Moser said, now we understood why he was stuck there, you know, for Selichos. He says, he stopped, this would be a very big event. It's one of the forbidden arayos, is to marry your brother's widow when there are children. It's only permitted. In other words, it's a funny thing. It becomes a mitzvah when there are no children, it becomes an aveira when there are. There's no in-between. Now today, I should say, today our custom is, we do not allow yibam among Ashkenazim, even if the brother, let's say, is single and wants to marry, we do not allow yibam. Well, because since technically marrying your brother's wife is a sin except for the mitzvah, we're afraid our kavanah is not totally for the mitzvah, therefore it becomes kind of a simple union. So we only do chalitza. But chalitza is something, I could very well be that unless people know the halacha or are connected with a rav that would advise them. I mean, I would guess that there might even be Orthodox women out there that are not aware of this institution of chalitza. Anyway, but we're going to see further on in the Gilas Rus that there's a whole discussion which seems to be reminiscent of Yibam and even chalitza And I just want to point you out at the outset, we'll go into what that is exactly, that we're not dealing with pure halachic yibam simply because Boaz, to Mahlon, who was Ruth's husband, was not Mahlon's brother, but it was Mahlon's cousin. Boaz was the son of Salmon. Mahlon was the son of Elimelech. Elimelech and Salmon are brothers. They're the children of Nachshon ben Aminadab. So therefore, we're dealing with something else, although we'll see exactly what that something else is. I'm sorry, someone had a hand up? Yeah. No, there's not. The other way is much worse. If a woman marries her husband's brother and has children, any new children she has are mamzerim. That is considered a purely incestuous relationship. Mm. On the other hand, a yevama who marries another person without benefit of chalitza has committed a negative commandment, but the children are not present. They don't have a stigma. Okay. All right. So the issue now I want to discuss is... they married Moabite women. I'm sorry.
I just don't understand the timeline.
Yeah.
If Nachshon was the one who jumped into
the Red Sea, yeah.
The Red Sea, and they were in the desert for 40 years.
Well, it all depends. Well, actually, the timeline, insofar as the Megillah is concerned, is not necessarily problematical because, like this, the only date we're given is it happened in the time of the judges. Now let's figure that out. When did the period of the judges begin? The Jewish people wandered in the desert for 40 years. Then they come, they're under the leadership of Yehoshua for 40 years. And the period of the judges begins right then. So the period of the judges does begin 80 years after they left Egypt. So theoretically, Elimelech would be an older person, but theoretically it is possible for this to be in the period of the judges. He could be a son of Nachshon. The only problem is we're going to see that based on the identity of Boaz, this seems to be located, and Eglon as well, this seems to be located pretty much into the period of the judges, around over 100 years.
Nachshon was very young.
Then you have a problem. So you have to assume that either Nachshon lived a long time, etc.
Or he was very young when he started.
Yeah, but you know, but there are going to be, you're going to have to make a certain assumption about how long Nachshon lived. Yeah. That's right. Well, the problem is with Ifson. That Ifson is Boaz is Ifson. That's much further along. Right. Yeah, that would be true. The Ifson is going to be a problem, especially since Ifson and Boaz are portrayed as very, very old at this time, which would push it even further into the period. Okay, now, as I say, one of the fundamental, just interpretive questions is, were Rus and Orpah non-Jewish women that Mahlon and Chilion married?
They didn't come that way, right?
Or, well, this is what I'm discussing, or, when it says they were Moabite women, the presupposition was they did undergo a conversion process. In other words, did they marry converted women? Which wouldn't be a sin, because remember, even though the Torah says you can't marry Moabite convert, that only applies to the men and not to the women. Although that was forgotten, but at least they were acting halachically proper. If, however, they were non-Jewish women, then chas v'shalom, they're committing the sin of intermarriage. So the truth of the matter is, there are two different opinions in the Midrashim. There are Midrashim that say Mahlon and Chilion married non-Jewish women, and I'll discuss, and they did not convert. In fact, that, and that's the opinion that Rashi follows.
Yeah, because Ruth said, Amech Hamid.
Yeah, I'll discuss it. And therefore, they did not convert. And there are other Midrashim that say Ruth and Orpah did convert. Now, let me just share with you why each of those views is a problematical. In other words, either way you say, there's going to be a problem in the Megillah story. And that is, we're going to read that Naomi and Orpah both want, I'm sorry, Ruth and Orpah, both, when Naomi finally decides, after she lost her husband and lost her sons, and she spent 10 years in Moab, that finally God has brought redemption and prosperity to the Jewish people, she wants to go back. She wants to go back. And Ruth and Orpah want to go with her. And we find that Naomi tries to discourage both of her daughters-in-law from going back. Go back to your nation. Why be with me? Why stay with me? Go back and marry other people. You're still young. And in fact, Chazal learn out of here that when somebody wants to convert to Judaism, our initial response has to be to try to discourage them, because that's the only way you can test their sincerity. And we learn it from the fact that Naomi tries to discourage Ruth and Orpah, and Orpah turns her back, as it were. Orpah leaves, and Naomi and Ruth stays. Now, if Ruth and Orpah had already become Jewish, if they had undergone a conversion ceremony, they're two Jewish people. Of course they have to go with her. You don't send them back to Moab. So that would lend support to Rashi's interpretation, based on the Midrash, that Ruth and Orpah were non-Jewish women totally, and the conversion of Ruth, which we're not told where was the base of them, there are a lot of questions we're not told, but whatever, however the conversion took place, it did not take place until Naomi took her back to Eretz Yisrael. That would support Rashi's pshat. However, well, the question is that if you're Jewish, why would you tell her to go back to her gods? Well, because she was living, but she was living with a Jewish man. So now go back to your society. Now, the problem, so that is a good support for Rashi, that they were non-Jewish women, and the conversion took place when Naomi is going back, and Orpah didn't want it, and Ruth accepted it. And that's why you have to discourage it. But the problem with this is it's very hard to understand the significance of the events at the end of Megillah. Now, just to go back a little bit. At the end of the Megillah, we will find that Naomi very much wants Boaz to marry Ruth. And the phrase that is used is, because this will, lahakim shem, this will reestablish the name of Mahlon, my deceased son. Now, the Ramban in his Perish al Torah has a very important point. Granted, we are not dealing, what is the purpose of Yibam? Yibam also is that when a person dies without children, his brother should perpetuate his lineage by taking his wife and bearing a child. And in a Kabbalistic way, it is actually said, the child the brother bears is actually a child of the dead person, of the deceased. Now, the Ramban next following point. Before Matan Torah, the concept of Yibam, perpetuating the memory of the deceased, was not limited to brothers. Even other relatives that had some connection. In fact, that's how the Ramban explains. If you look at Yehuda and Tamar, now all of that is before Matan Torah. What happened? Yehuda had a son, Er, that married Tamar, and Er died, and then Onan married Tamar, and Onan died because they did sins. And Yehuda did not want his third son to marry Tamar, but what did Tamar do? Tamar enticed Yehuda, her father-in-law, to be with her. Was that legitimate? The Ramban says it was, because the concept of Yibam, of perpetuating the memory of the dead, could even apply before Matan Torah to other relatives. Now, Rus is not before Matan Torah. Rus is after Matan Torah. But the Ramban says the following. Even if obligatory Yibam, only applies when you have a brother, a concept of optional Yibam, the spiritual idea of Yibam, applies even with other relatives. And therefore the Ramban says, Naomi wants Boaz, a first cousin, to marry Ruth, because although Boaz is not a brother, but there is no surviving brother, Boaz as a next of kin could perpetuate the neshama of Mahlon in a child that we would have. So the Ramban does understand that the Megillus Rus is invoking the idea of Yibam, although it's not obligatory Yibam. But here is the question. In order to say that Boaz is doing Yibam, that presupposes Rus was married to Mahlon. Now, if Rus was a non-Jewish woman, yeah, who lived with Mahlon, there was no marriage at all. Right? If a non-Jewish woman is married to a Jew, and after the Jew dies, she decides to convert to Judaism, there's no concept of Yibam, because Yibam only applies when there was a halachic marriage. the marriage of a Jew to a non-Jew is a nullity, right? You know, there's no get, there's no nothing. A Jew who marries a non-Jew is not married. So that would indicate, therefore, that there already was a conversion. So in effect, we have a contradiction in the Megillah itself. The fact that Naomi is discouraging them from coming indicates that you were not Jewish. The fact that we invoke Yibum presupposed there was a marriage, which means they were Jewish. Right? So there's a contradiction in the Megillah itself. Were they Jewish? Were they not Jewish already? Did they convert?
To make sure
did they
didn't know, probably. That's why.
Well, so there's a problem. Rashi doesn't answer this problem. Rashi asserts in the beginning they were not Jewish, but he doesn't explain why would there be anything like Yibum at the end of the story. So there's a very, very interesting answer that the Zohar gives for this. It's a non-mystical answer, actually, just a very straightforward halachic answer. And the Zohar says the following. The Zohar says, certainly, Rus and Orpah both underwent a conversion process. They both underwent a conversion process. Because we can assume that the boys wouldn't have married non-Jewish women without a conversion. Let me finish. Now, the thing is this. They converted. However, there's a great suspicion in these types of conversions that you're converting. Because remember, here we have Rus and Orpah, royalty, who are marrying aristocracy of the Jewish people. So there is always a suspicion when a conversion is done for the sake of marriage. Is it a valid conversion? Or is it an invalid conversion? Right? Now that doesn't mean it's invalid. It means we're doubtful whether it's valid. Because if it's sincere, it's valid. If it's insincere, it's invalid. So how do you know if it's a sincere conversion or an insincere conversion? You look at how the parties behave when the reason for that conversion evaporates. The reason for the conversion was marriage to two people who were wealthy and prestigious. They now died, and Naomi herself is now poor. If Rus is willing to stay, so it's not the pshat she's converting now. Her willingness to stay shows that she was Jewish all the way from the beginning. Orpah converted too. Her unwillingness to stay shows that the conversion was insincere from the beginning. So now everything is answered. Why does Naomi discourage them if they convert it? Because whether the conversion is valid or not depends on how they respond right now. But why is there Yibum? Because the one who's willing to stay isn't becoming Jewish from today, but it shows that the conversion was sincere all the way back. In other words, this basically teaches us a very important, very problematic halacha, actually, because we often have the shaila like this. There's a shaila in the real world where you have people who undergo an Orthodox conversion, and then they stop living a Torah life. Now, the question is, if an Orthodox convert stops living a Torah life, does that invalidate their conversion and make them a goy? Our answer is no. Why is that? Once you convert, you're a Jew. If a Jewish person commits aveiros, they still remain Jewish. So who cares if you're Jewish by birth or Jewish by conversion? A Jew is a Jew. And if you sin later, that's a separate thing of Yom Kippur and Shuvah, but that does not invalidate conversion. However, there's an exception to that, and that is the following. If at the time of the conversion, there are reasons to suspect that it's not sincere, meaning there might be marriage, there might be money, there might be other reasons, then indeed the behavior of a later date may invalidate. But that only applies in the case where at the time of the conversion there were suspicions. That would not apply to a person who converts in good faith. That was a big problem. I don't know if any of you remember this. This was in the 1970s when Rav Shlomo Gorin was the chief rabbi of Israel. And he was very controversial. And one of his one of the most controversial things he did was there was a question about the brother and sister, the Langer siblings. both of them wanted to get married to different people. You know, they wanted to get married, and the Rabbanut had said they couldn't because they were born from their mother's second marriage, and the mother's first marriage was not terminated by a get. Therefore, their second mother's second marriage is adulterous. Therefore, they're mamzerim, and they cannot marry. So the Langers were outraged. They went to the Israeli Supreme Court, etc. And Rav Gorin came out with a psak this way. Mrs. Langer's first husband was a person who had been born Catholic and who had converted to Judaism. And after being, you know, and eventually at some point in his life he became not frum. So Rav Gorin came up with the idea, oh, well, if a ger becomes not frum, that means his gerus was not sincere. Therefore, he was a goy. Therefore, the mother was never married. Therefore, the second marriage is the only marriage. Yeah. Therefore, the kids are not mamzerim. Now, he issued this psak, and he had a base then, he said, of nine other rabbis who concurred. But he did not say who they were, because he said he didn't want any retaliation against them. So this was an anonymous psak. And again, there were a lot of reasons. I mean, this really, people were going crazy over this. But part of, you know, Abraham Baruski was not very happy that after being a Jew for 65 years, a rabbinic court comes along and said, you were never Jewish. And the truth of the matter is, I mean, the mistake of Rav Gorin was, shouldn't be a mistake, but the reason why people disagreed with him was, we never take the position, if a ger commits averos later on, that invalidates the conversion, unless there was a problem at the beginning of the conversion. Otherwise, we'd have a lot of, again, once you're a ger, you're a Jew. If you're a Jew, what you do later is a separate matter. It does not invalidate the conversion. But Rav Gorin, you know, in the interest of saving two children from Mamzeris, he kind of bent the rules a little bit. But this was a very, this was probably the most controversial. He did many controversial things. This was probably the biggest controversy of his tenure. He was just nifter, I think, a short while ago. I think.
Yeah, right.
2 years ago, I think.
No, yeah. Mel.
So what happened to the guy who, what was his name?
Baruski.
Yeah.
I don't remember the aftermath. I don't think Rav Gorin rescinded the psak. So Rav Gorin was, as the chief rabbi, was the administrative head of the system. So he allowed them to marry, but their marriages were not recognized by any other rabbi in Israel. I mean, officially he's the boss, so if he said they could go ahead, they went ahead, but no one else accepted that decision.
What about their children?
Yeah, exactly.
Their children would be mamzerim. That's 100% correct.
And what about the guy who got declared non-Jewish?
Well, he was treated by everyone else as Jewish. Mm-hmm. In a way, he got more positive attention than
he sort of like was a Balshuva.
Well, what happened was, yeah, that was the problem. He became a Balshuva. That was the problem, really. In other words, he had an Orthodox conversion,
right.
And then he was not religious for a number of years. Then he became religious again. He became a Balshuva.
Right.
And then Rav Gorin says, sorry, you're a goy. You know, so he didn't feel that great about it.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, he had the option of reconverting then, but, you know, he didn't want to do that. So,
can a get be retroactive?
No. No, a get is effective only when it's given. Yeah, I guess, why didn't he give a get? I guess that those were the years, I guess he was not religious. That must have been the situation. Neither he or his wife were religious, so they just didn't think about a get. By the way, again, this is a related problem about this. You know, people talk about the aguna issue of women who want a get and their husbands refuse to give it to them, and that's a very painful issue. But you should know that as painful as the aguna issue is, it does not involve a large number of women. Much larger than the aguna issue is not women who want to get don't get it, but simply non-religious couples who divorce and nobody thinks about it again. And then they have children from a second marriage, and the kid might become a Baal Shuvah, and therefore he may be a mamzer. And that is a very, very serious problem. In any institution that deals with adults who become religious, they often have to confront.
So the rabbi are causing it, but not by not.
What are the rabbis caused by doing what?
Like what the rabbis caused? Why didn't they give a divorce? Why didn't they force the man to get a
divorce?
No,
but here I'm saying you have a situation where people didn't even realize. But here, on the other hand, Rav Moshe has a very important tshuva that Rav Moshe says in many of the cases of the non-religious getting married, the first marriage was not valid. Because you didn't have kosher witnesses, and therefore you didn't need a get. So in a lot of the reform situations, even without a get, you're all right. So, Baruch Hashem, I mean, that was a very... Rav Moshe did not say it because it was useful for him. He said it because it was right. But that has been a big, big lifesaver for many, many people.
So your children, in that case, your mother, couldn't they convert?
No. No, because their mother was Jewish. Their mother was Jewish. And therefore, they are mamzerim. A mamzer cannot. A mamzer is Jew. A goy can convert to a Jew, but a mamzer cannot convert into a non-mamzer. Well, you know, that's the difficulty of the idea of a mamzer all the time. It is a big question. All I can say is I can answer the question with a question. I mean, the concept that children do suffer because of parental behaviors does exist in the physical world. I mean, babies get AIDS because the parents were intravenous drug users. I mean, it happens, and we have this question. Why do children, you know, suffer? Because of, you know, the children are so innocent. That is the nature of the world, that what we do does impact in our children, and that's true in the spiritual sense. Again, that doesn't answer the question, I'm just raising another question, but it shows that that is what the way the world works.
If mamzerus ever stop in a line of...
No, there's only one way it could stop. Now, the Torah says until the 10th generation, but Chazal say that's just an expression. It means forever and ever. I'll tell you the way it could stop. It could stop, this is a prohibited way, but it would work. And that is, if a male mamzer were to live with a non-Jewish woman, he's not allowed to. The child from the non-Jewish woman would be a non-Jew because of the mother. If the non-Jew then converts, they are a newborn child that is no longer a mamzer. So that is a way, but I want to emphasize that is not permitted. No, it's wild. A mamzer is not allowed to marry a non-Jew. Now, there is a permissible way that the Mishnah says, and the question is whether you do it today. I actually saw it advocated today. That is, at a time when you had non-Jewish slaves, so a mamzer is allowed to marry a non-Jewish shivcha, kananas, a non-Jewish slave, and then the child of a shivcha is a slave, and if you free the slave, that's like a conversion. So that would be permissible. So I actually saw articles that, you know, there is no halachic impediment against the institution of slavery. So, of course, this would be pro forma slavery, so to speak. I mean, it's illegal under the 13th Amendment to the Constitution in the United States, but you know, can't have slavery. But the concept would be, here's the problem. You have Reuven that's a mamzer. So Reuven goes over to a non-Jewish woman and says, you know, I'm not allowed to marry you as a non-Jew, but if you're willing to become my slave, I'm the search.
Yeah,
and she has to go to the mikveh. There's a procedure to become a shivcha. If you become my slave and we have a child, that child will
That's
be
easy
okay.
Way, really.
Now, the problem is this. The problem is that he could then free the child and the child will be a convert and that's fine. But he could then... No, he would not be allowed to free his wife, though, because his wife would then become... No, that would be good. He could free, remember, a mamzer could marry a giyoris. A mamzer could marry a converted Jewess. The only thing is, if he simply marries a giyoris, see, if a mamzer marries a giyoris, the child he has is still a mamzer. But, so, he has a child while she's a slave. That child is now freed, converted, is Jewish. And then, at the point in which they no longer want to have children, he can then free her. She could be a giyoris, and they could live happily ever after.
Wow.
So there is a way to work it out, but you have to find a willing person. Of course, there are women that say, you know, that's what I am anyway. You know, so what's
the difference?
Yeah.
Jeez, that's it.
No, a daughter that's a mamzeres has no way of escaping other than if she has a son, it can be replicated in the next generation. But there's no direct way of helping the first generation.
She can marry
male or she can marry a gair. In other words, a mamzer does have marriage options. The only question is the options in terms of limiting the transmission is very limited. Yeah. Okay, so that's just a little bit of the detail here. But the Zohar there, for the Zohar is very, very nice because the Zohar reconciles all of the issues. Meaning to say, Rus and Orpah did undergo a pro forma conversion, but there were halachic clouds whether that was legitimate, and the way we measure its legitimacy is how they behave at a later point in time when the attractiveness goes off. Therefore, Rus did not become Jewish only after Machlon dies. Rather, her willingness to go along shows that she was Jewish all the way back, which is why there would be a concept of Yibum to perpetuate her marriage to Machlon. The Rambam says the same idea is the way we understand Shlomo HaMelech's wives, right? Shlomo HaMelech married all of these wives.
Yeah, thousands
that were
wives.
Idolatrous, the daughter of Paro and everything else. So the Rambam says Shlomo did not marry non-Jewish women. Certainly the women were converted. However, the very fact that they reverted to their idolatrous ways shows that the conversion was not sincere, and the conversion was just done for the purpose of marrying into a powerful royal family. By the way, this is a major scandal even in Israel today. We have all sorts of conversions going on in Israel to be on basketball teams. I mean, you know, there are...
Yeah.
I mean, somebody told me there's a rabbi in a community, not in the United States, who is now indicted for selling conversion papers and the like. So it's a major, major problem of conversions that are not done with shame, Kabbalah, accepting
of mitzvahs. What happens to the children?
Well,
if there's a period when they're considered Jewish,
that's a complicated question. You know, in a sense, if the children themselves are observant and want to live a Torah life, in a sense, they have the option of redoing their own geiris, in a sense. So it's not that difficult. Although, once again, they could marry a kohen, perhaps. But many people say that once a geiris was done with the evet, we do accept it as valid. But on the other hand, the Rambam seems to say that. You know, so that's the. I mean, this comes up over and over and over again. You know, because people are so aware, you know, they say in Israel, you know, only Orthodox conversions are good. So every couple that adopts, even if they're totally non-affiliated, they say they want their adopted child, who's non-Jewish, to have an Orthodox conversion because we want it to be accepted in Israel. No, it's not really clear that they're thinking of going to Israel. I mean, but, you know, it has to be accepted in Israel. And, you know, rabbis are asked all the time to do conversions for little children who the parents are not, committed to do anything. And different rabbis respond in different ways. I mean, there are those, I will not tell you my thing, I don't want to talk about my thing, but there are those that would say, we will not do any geiris unless the parents are from people. There are those that say, no matter how unfrom the parents are, it is a privilege to bring a child into the Jewish faith, and we will do it. And there are those that are middle of the road that might say, well, the parents don't have to be strictly from, but they might insist that the home be kosher, and they try to keep Shabbos, and they commit to give the child a Jewish education so that the child will be exposed to what is needed to make a religious decision. So there are many, many different approaches here. And this is, of course, a tremendous issue with the Russian populations, because, as you know, both in Israel and in here, more than one-third of the Russian Jewish kids are not Jewish at all. They're not Jewish. But the question is, we could do the conversion that we do to minor children. The question then becomes, okay, we do, but what are the standards that we impose on the parents when we do conversions for minor children? And that's why, once again, you will find a tremendous diversity of approaches as to how to deal with that problem. And in Eretz Israel, it's a tremendous problem. I mean, I read now that there have already been like anti-Semitic defacing of Jewish institutions by Russian people who live in Israel. they're coming in, you know, as you know, and they're
running away from
they're
Russia.
So some of them are so non-Jewish that they're already, you know, expressing anti-Semitism in the state of Israel. You know, so you know, it's a difficult problem because on one hand, you know, the mitzvah of saving Jews is so important that, you know, if you can get, you know, one Jew out of 10,000 there at Israel, you want to do so. You know, you want to, if there's any chance at all, you want to bring people in. On the other hand, you know, it's a big, you know, it's a big problem. You don't want to, you know, recreate Russian anti-Semitism, you know, in the state of Israel. But those are some of the things that.
It's not
that
a haven for everybody.
So when people talk about the conversion crisis as, you know, do we recognize conservative and reform conversions? You know, that's what maybe what Americans think is the big crisis. In Israel, that's not really a big crisis other than Federation money, because there aren't that many conservative reform conversions in Israel. But the issue of conversion is dealing with the Russians, what type of conversions, and dealing with some of the Ethiopian Jews. There you're dealing with tens of thousands,
and they open
hundreds
church,
of thousands of
and
people.
And they clearly
right.
have churches
right.
in Israel.
That is the conversion crisis in Eretz Israel, not really the conservative reform, which is a very, very small number.
Yeah.
Well, not as much as the Russians, because many Ethiopians are really fully Torah observant and want to be Torah observant. The issue there is not so much what are the standards for conversion. The issue is that many Ethiopians are reluctant to convert because they say that we are Jewish. So that's where you have, it's a different type of issue. With the Russians, the issue is, you know, they don't want to do it. Of course, there are many Russians who obviously want to keep mitzvahs, but the many do not want to keep mitzvahs, but they just want to get out of Russia. And the question then becomes, what type of conversion do you keep?
But you know, the Ethiopian comes and opens a church, and they have...
Well, Israel's a democracy, and Christians are allowed to...
Yeah, but they come as Jews, and then they...
I came across many, many Ethiopians that are lovely, lovely people, and very, very observant Jews. Yeah, okay, but the policy of Israel has to be that if there's a chance to save Jews, you let them in.
Yeah, Jews, but not.
It creates really, really severe demographic problems. So these are not easy things. Okay, but be it as it may, this is the Zohar HaKadosh's understanding of what's going on with Rus and Orpah. There was a pro forma conversion. Now again, the Megillah doesn't indicate, well, who did the conversion exactly? I mean, in order for there to be a Geirus, right, what do you need? All right, you need a mikveh. Right. I guess a mikveh, but the Jordan River could be a mikveh. That would be fine. You need a basin. Basin means you would need three men to be on a basin who are shomer mitzvos. So we have to assume, where do you find them in Moab? Right? We have to assume that probably Elimelech had an entourage with him. In other words, he wasn't the only one. There were other people there, and they were able to make a basin, but it was a suspicious conversion because there were all sorts of reasons why the conversion might not be sincere. Okay, so that's a yisod to remember. So the pasuk says they lived there for 10 years, and Mahlon v'Chilion then died, and the woman was left alone with her two children. Actually, it's a very beautiful phrase. I mean, Mahlon v'Chilion are adults, right? But it says she was left bereft of her two yiladim. Shnei yiladah, right? So now a yelad, we know, normally means a young child. And really, it's very evocative of a mother's feeling towards her son. Her son may have been 50 or 60, but it's her little boy, right? Her little boys are not here anymore, right? So you can see the pain that she has.
No, for a mother
in her
any
heart.
Age, children are yeladah.
That's right. Ume Isha, and from her husband as well. That was something that she missed. In fact, Chazal say a very beautiful thing. If you look in Pasuk Gimel, Pasuk Gimel says, Vayamas Elimelech, Ish Naomi. Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died. Why does it have to say the husband of Naomi? We know he's the husband. So Rashi says the following, that when a man dies, it is only his wife that really feels it. Meaning to say that, of course, the loss of a parent is tragic, but there was a dimension of closeness that, in effect, only she felt that level of loss, that no one else in the world could feel that level of loss. Ein adam meis elo liyishto. When a man dies, it is the wife that has lost. Because, you know, children, as the nature of the world go on, you know, have their own sphere of activity, and one of the, not tragic, but actually it's happy in some ways, but one of the somber ideas of life is that as soon as our children are born, they begin the process of leaving us. Of course, hopefully, you're always connected, but there is the notion of stepping away a little bit. So the real loss is the husband and the wife, even more so than the parent and the child. So then it says that Yusigam Shnei Machlon B'Chilyon, and the woman was left bereft of her two children, her two boys, and from her husband.
So if Elimelech was alive, he wouldn't let his boys to marry.
It could be that perhaps she had less control over them than he would have had. We don't know, but it could very well be that that's why it emphasizes he died first. So now she and her daughters-in-law arise, and they return from the fields of Moab, because she had heard that God had remembered his people to give them bread. Now, is this a suggestion? See, I'm not sure what this means. If you read this literally, this seems to be a famine of a 10-year duration. It's like, I mean, it shouldn't take that long for news to get from Israel to Moab. I mean, it's not exactly, even without internet and email, it's not exactly a great distance. Let's say it takes a week, you know, to get there. So the suggestion seems to be,
well, she was lonely, and she...
Well, but it says she returned after 10 years because she finally heard that Hashem has remembered the people, his nation, to give them bread. So, say again? It says 10 years, that's what it's right. It says 10 years. It says they were there for 10 years.
Yeah,
Pasuk Dalet says 10 years.
It's a care, it's a shanim.
No, approximately 10 years, yeah. About 10 years.
Yeah.
So one explanation is this. One explanation is that maybe this had happened a long time before, but her sons were so entrenched in the Moabite culture that they didn't let her leave, or she had no, right? Now that they're gone, she now says, I can go back. In other words, it doesn't mean that now there has been a change. Maybe the change was 8 years ago, but she was not. Her husband, when her husband was there, when her children were there, which is an interesting point. I just want to show you, there's a similar parallel to Mitzrayim. If you remember, the Haggadah makes this point. When it says, Arami Oved Avi, Lavan the Aramean tried to destroy my father. Vayered Mitzrayim, and he went to Mitzrayim. Vayagar Sham, and he went there as a stranger. What does the Haggadah say? Shelo Yarad Yaakov Avinu Lishtakeya B'Mitzrayim. Yaakov did not come to be a permanent resident of Egypt. He went there with the kavana that I am a stranger, I'm an alien, I don't want to belong there.
Temporary.
Now, interestingly enough, and I think there might be a direct parallel here, look in Pasuk Aleph again. They went, or Elimelech went, Lagur B'Stei Moav. Maybe that also means he was telling his wife,
temporary.
We're not going to live here. But the years go on. Now, it's not 210 years, but in the life of a family, 10 years is a significant portion. So what might have happened is, maybe Elimelech liked the life of Moab. There were fewer mishulachim, people weren't collecting for charity and the like. It was more comfortable. You see, so we have this idea that people often say, well, we're going to move here for a while, like people come, let's say, from Eretz Israel, be in America a few years, get enough money to go back, etc. But what happens really to all of us is, you know, well, we're comfortable,
and they stay.
We don't want to change. And she now says, okay, I've lost my husband, I've lost my sons. It doesn't say specifically that she's poor, although the context of the whole Megillah, the fact
there's
that the say. Fact that they have to, you know, glean the leanings, indicates that the gleanings indicates that she is in a state of poverty. She now says, what's my excuse? What am I going to say? Life is going to be harder for me there? No, not at all. I've already hit bottom here. Then I might as well be there. If I'm going to be poor, let me be poor in Eretz Yisrael.
And she is always afraid not to die also.
Yeah, well, that could be also. That's right. So at this point, she finally, as it were, although not, it's not in a good sense, she is freed of the pressures that would keep her in Moab. And now she's free to go to Eretz Yisrael. And Teitse min Amakom, Pasuk Zayin, she leaves the place that she was there with her two daughters-in-law, and she goes, by the way, you see, by the way, that every verb is always she, it does not say they, meaning she is the one that is motivated to go. They are following her out of loyalty, but it's not their idea. They didn't come up with the idea, let's go back to Eretz Yisrael. She's come up with this idea. And then Naomi turns to her two daughters-in-law and says, Lechna, go back. Shovna, Isha lebeit ima, each woman to her mother. Now again, this is what you said before. This is why the Midrash says that although Rus and Orpah are sisters from the same father, in fact, Eglon had many wives, so each one had a different mother that they would go back to. Yas Hashem imachem chesed, may God do for you loving kindness. Kasher asisem im hameisim v'imadi, as you have done for the dead ones, her sons and her husband, those who are no longer here. V'imadi, and with me. And then she gives them a blessing that may they get married again. Yitein Hashem lachem, may God give you. Umitzena menucha, may you find repose. Again, it's actually a beautiful expression, which Naomi uses over and over again, even with Boaz. The concept of marriage is a menucha. Menucha is rest. Now, what do we mean rest? We don't mean it's restful. Things can be very turbulent. But there should be an inner, in an ideal situation, we don't always have it all the time, but in an ideal situation, there should be a sense of serenity, a sense of rootedness, a sense that you have a place, right? The opposite of menucha is constant, frenetic movements, not having any place that you could set your roots down. And therefore, her bracha is, and again, it's coming from the fact that she feels the opposite right now. Her feelings are turbulent. Her feelings are anxious. Her feelings are fearful. And therefore, from her perspective, the greatest blessing she could give in terms of marriage is, may you find a menucha. Isha lebeit, isha beis isha, right? The mapik means her husband. In other words, each woman in a home with her husband.
New husband, yeah.
And vatish, right? Which is also very nice. In other words, she's not insisting, never get married again. She's saying, I want you to get married again. I want you to have a home. I want you to have menucha. Vatisha klahen. And she kisses them.
She was a good mother-in-law.
Yeah, of course. Vatisena kolan, and they all raise their voice. I guess all means all three, not just Rus and Orpah, but they all cry together. The sorrow of parting. Vativkena, and they cry. But they both say, so remember, we shouldn't look at Orpah in a negative way. I mean, although Orpah, she turned her back. I mean, Orpah didn't just say, bye, see you in 20 years. By the way, Orpah's child from her later marriage and life was none other than Goliath, the giant. So Orpah had some good genes there for gigantism or whatever it was. And it's very interesting, therefore, that it was Rus's great-grandson, David,
David and Goliath,
who waged war against the Orpah's son, Goliath.
Mm-hmm.
But Vatomarla, Tomarnala, and they both said, so Orpah said it too, Ki tachno shuv li'ameich, we want to go back to your nation. And then we have the famous statement, Vatomer Naomi, Shovna benosai, go back, my daughters. You are like daughters to me. Lama seilachna imi, why should you go with me?
Okay,
right, this is the predicate that you try to discourage. Ha'od li banim b'me'ai, are there children in my womb that could be forever? Now, by the way, this is Rashi. Rashi brings a proof from here that they were not converted. This is Rashi's opinion. Now, it's a little bit of a complicated proof, but it's very fascinating because it shows the integration of halacha into this. Naomi makes the point, I'm too old to get pregnant. And then she says, and even if I would have children today, are you going to wait 20 years? The implication of Naomi's remarks is, if she would have a child, and they'd be willing to wait, they could marry her child. Right? That's the implication of her remarks. She says, I'm not going to have the children, but if I could, you'd be able to marry them. Now here's the problem. The din of Yibum that says a brother marries the widow of a brother is only a brother who shared a common life, even if 1 second, with his brother. Meaning to say, if Reuven dies, and after Reuven dies, Reuven's mother has a child, that child, even if the woman is willing to wait 20 years, is not allowed to do Yibum or Chalitza. That is called Eshes Achiv, the wife of a brother, Shelo Hayav Olamo, that was never in the world with another brother. And that's based on the Pasuk, the Torah says of Yibum, Ki Yeshvu Achim Yachdav, brothers must have a common existence. Now here's the question. If Naomi has a child after Mahlon dies, any child she has is an ach who did not share a common existence. So how could she suggest there be the permissibility of Yibum? It got to be, says Rashi, that since Rus and Orpah never converted, they were never married to Mahlon v'Chilion, and therefore there wouldn't be a bond. So Rashi actually brings a proof from that halacha. Of course, there's another problem too. The other problem is, any child Naomi would have would not be a paternal brother of Mahlon, because Elimelech is dead too. It would only be a half-brother from the same mother, and there's no Yibum on that at all, which is another reason why there's a problem. But basically, Naomi says, just in terms of pshat, that, number one, I'm not going to get pregnant, and even if I would be able to get pregnant, are you going to wait for all those years? Zakanti miyos liish. I'm too old to get married. Meaning she's even saying my marriage possibilities are not good anymore. Ki amarti, and even if I would say, yesh li tikva, I have some hope. I mean, you see, in a sense, kind of the despondency. In other words, I'm a person without hope. And even if I would have hope, Gam ha'isi alaylish, even if I'd be with a man this very night, v'gam yoladet ibanim, and even if I would give birth this very night, obviously that's impossible. Not only would I be married, I get pregnant and give birth starting now. What are we going to do here? Halahen tisaberna? Are you going to wait for them? Ad asher yigdalu, till they become adults? Halohen teogena, right, this is the word aguna. Aguna is to be anchored, to be unable to move. Are you going to anchor yourselves? Levilti heyos liish, not to be married to anybody else. Now, one thing we might question is this. What exactly is the logic of what Naomi is saying? I mean, after all,
according to her,
Rus and Orpah do convert, either they did already or they will now, they don't have to wait. Why is there the assumption that the only marriage people in the Jewish people that they will possibly have are Naomi's children? Then she's saying, I'm not going to have any kids. Well, their response to that is, so what? You're not going to have any kids. I mean, we're joining the Jewish people. We'll marry somebody else. You see? So here, what is going on is the following. Remember that the Torah does prohibit the marrying of Moabite converts. But that only applies to the male, not the female. However, that is the halacha. However, in Klal Yisrael, that halacha was not well known. And therefore Naomi is basically saying, listen, in my family we've accepted that halacha because my own kids married you. But she's basically telling them, you're going to face such a level of discrimination in the general Jewish society that your only chance of marriage is going to be in my family, and that's impossible. They're not going to have children, right? That's basically the idea. And in point of fact, indeed, the one who wound up marrying Rus was indeed in Naomi's family, right? It was the nephew of her husband, right? So that's why she's bringing this up, both in order to discourage them and to express the reality that Jews are not going to marry Moabites. Moabites were a hated people, and even if the technical halacha permits the marrying of a female Moabite convert, people weren't doing it, and people thought it was also halachically wrong, because they weren't aware of these chilukim. I mentioned last week that even in David HaMelech's life, people always brought up the idea, oh, you come from a Moabite, so you're puzzle. That was brought up over and over and over again. In fact, I think I mentioned last week that the reason Shmuel Hanavi wrote the Megillah of Rus was to validate the permissibility of David's lineage by showing that Boaz, who was a great leader, married Rus publicly. Okay, so she. That's right. Tov made a mistake. Tov felt he could not marry a female Moabite. But Tov, the Gemara says, was an Am Haaretz. Tov did not know this halacha, and Boaz did. And by the way, Boaz did not attempt to correct Tov. It was very interesting that when Tov says, "I can't marry her because she's Moabite," Boaz just goes ahead and marries her himself. Now you might think, why doesn't he tell Tov the halacha? So we see from here that if you have a great opportunity to do a mitzvah and someone doesn't want to do it because they're under a misapprehension, you're not obligated to correct it, because you can allocate to yourself the opportunity to do a mitzvah. As long as you don't lie, you don't have to correct someone's mistake. You can go ahead and take advantage.
She was young and he was old.
Yeah, we'll discuss. Yeah, we haven't really reached Boaz yet, but when we get to Boaz, we'll talk about who he is. Now, they cried, and at this point already, Orpah turns back, right? Orpah goes back, and then Naomi turns to Rus and says, "Your Yavama, right, your sister-in-law, has gone back to her nation and her gods. Go, you do it too." So then we have one of the famous speeches in the Tanakh, Rus's desire to stay with Naomi. "Vatomer Rus al tifki bi," do not entreat me, do not pressure me. "Liozveich," to abandon you. "Loshuv miacharayach," to go away from you. "Ki el asher telchi eleich," where you go, I will go. "Where you sleep, where you lodge, I will lodge. Your nation is my nation, your God is my God. As you die, so shall I die. And there I want to be buried." So Rashi says the following. Rashi says a very interesting idea, that from Rus's responses, we infer a whole bunch of things that Naomi was saying to Rus, which Rus is answering. In other words, Rus is answering different issues that Naomi brought up. Naomi brought up the following. Naomi is bringing up all sorts of halachas to kind of discourage her. And she says, we're not allowed to go more than 2,000 cubits on Shabbos, right? In other words, unless there are continuous houses, you're limited to a tichum of 2,000. So that's what she says, where you go, I will go. You can't go there, I won't go there. Then she says, we're not allowed to have yichud. We're not allowed to be secluded with a man that's not our husband. Where you sleep, I will sleep. Right? I will observe those laws. We have 613 mitzvahs, generally, a lot of commandments. Your nation is my nation. We only worship one God. Your God is my God. There are capital punishments for different sins. How you die, how you accept death penalties, I accept it, and I will be buried there as well. That's another, she's accepting upon herself the totality of mitzvahs. Now, one interesting thing we have to think about, though, is this. What exactly is Rus's motivation to become Jewish? Rus wants to be religious? It seems from the psukim itself that what motivates her to want to become part of the Jewish people is the love and concern that she has for her mother-in-law. And in effect, that is the ultimate Kiddush Hashem, right? What is a Kiddush Hashem? That you live your life in such a good way that those who are attached with you want to be like you. They want to live like you. They want to spend time with you. So although you might say, that's right, although you might say, well, so in a deeper sense, that's not becoming Jewish for the sake of becoming Jewish. That's becoming Jewish for the sake of spending your life with your mother-in-law. But in effect, that is also considered to be a correct motive, meaning to say that it was the care that she had for Naomi and the love that she had for Naomi that made her want to be part of the Jewish people. And from Naomi, she saw the goodness of Torah and the goodness of serving Hashem, and that made her want to become part of that. So that also means, you see this sometimes, even in pure intermarriages, you sometimes see that the non-Jewish partner sometimes is the one who gets connected to Judaism and wants to become Jewish and bring the whole family to a higher Jewish level. So basically, we'll discuss this more by Arichas, but basically the concept is this in Kabbalah. When Avraham separated from Lot, right? Lot spent much of his life with Avraham. And because of that interaction of Avraham and Lot, there was holiness that was generated in Lot. Sparks of holiness, sparks of Kedusha. And those sparks of Kedusha became submerged and buried in the years of Lot with Sodom and in the selfishness and in the incest. But there were sparks that were transmitted from generation to generation, even through the incest of Moab and even through the cruelty of Moab in the desert. And those sparks were dormant, but they finally emerged in a special neshama. And the special neshama is the neshama of Rus. That Rus is the ultimate recipient, in mysterious ways that we don't know why, of all of the Kedusha that Lot had siphoned off, as it were, from Avraham. And now that Kedusha reunites into its ultimate source. And that produces Mashiach. Mashiach is reproduced, right? Because David Mashiach. Mashiach is reproduced when all of the sparks of holiness that are imprisoned in the world get liberated and reconnected into their sources. Okay, and that's Kibbutz Golias, in a very literal sense. The ingathering of the exiles doesn't only mean people who are in different countries come to Eretz Yisrael, but the ingathering of the exiles means the holiness that is imprisoned in many, many different places comes together and comes back to its source, right? And that is Rus. Rus is the return of the lost spark into the source from which it came. And that's why Mashiach comes from us, because that is what Mashiach does as well. So Rus goes back. And that's what Naomi says, she is refusing to go back. You stop talking to her, meaning to say, when you really see that the gayrus is sincere, you encourage them, you don't discourage anymore. And now it says, in other words, until this point, Naomi was walking and they were following her. Now they walk as equals. Now they are together. And they go until Boena Beis Lechem. And when they come to Beis Lechem, all of the city gathers. Can you imagine this? Naomi was such a prestigious family. And after 10 years, and of course, everyone had heard what happened. She had lost her husband and lost her children and lost their wealth. And now she's coming back. And you can imagine that everybody is standing around. But maybe they don't know exactly what to say. I mean, this is our problem all the time, that people have suffered, that we don't know exactly what to say, but we're just like watching, we're just there, waiting. Because it doesn't say, right? Well, it does say one thing they said, but it's not clear if they said it to her. One could imagine this might be a stage whisper. They said, "Is this Naomi?" Now you can imagine, that's not her, is it? But she overheard what they said. It could be, it doesn't say, but Tomar no law. They're saying to each other in amazement, "Is this the woman we used to know?" Right, that rich and young and with children and a family and with wealth and everything else. Yeah. And she overheard it. And she said, "Don't call me Naomi anymore. I'm not that woman." Naomi means sweet, pleasant. Mm-hmm. "I am now Mara. Call me bitter. Because God has done bitter things for me. I left filled with everything, filled with children and a family, and God has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi? God has punished me." And now again, the question is, how do we understand this? Is she complaining? Like, what exactly is the attitude? Is she complaining under Ribono Shel Olam? Or is she acknowledging, right? Is she acknowledging the justice of God's punishment? She is saying, look at what has befallen me. In other words, she's acknowledging the sin of leaving Israel, of letting her children marry Moabites, of not coming back earlier. Maybe she's acknowledging, maybe I should have been stronger with my husband. Right? There's a lot that's unsaid. Maybe I could have stood up for what would have been right. And therefore, I am Mara, I am the person that God has punished. Because the truth of the matter is, as many say, sometimes it is the survivor that may suffer more than the one that is taken. I have suffered. God has punished me more than he has punished my children. And the Pasuk basically says, the end of Perek Aleph, that they came to Beis Lechem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Now again, when is the barley harvested? Around Pesach time, right? So we are told they showed up right around Pesach, right? So this is Perek Aleph. Perek Aleph is the story of going to Moab, staying in Moab. And now the story will resume when they come to Eretz Yisrael. So we'll continue, God willing, next week.
Okay. So have a good day.